Hello there, you're listening to The Blockchain Socialist, and I'm here today with a special guest, Brett Scott, who is a financial activist and the author of The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, Hacking the Future of Money, and who also has a new book coming out next year. Hey, Brett, how are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Great to be here.
Thanks. Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to start off with, because I think it's a really interesting idea you have, and you've talked about a bit online that I've seen some presentations of, is what you call the war on cash. It's a really interesting way of thinking about how money is evolving in our everyday lives, from the physical to the digital world. And a lot of times, I think people who are on the right, especially like Austrian economists, also have this sort of war on cash as well, but from a much different angle than what you come from. So I was curious to hear if you can explain what your idea is on the war on cash.
I mean, in some ways, it's pretty simple. I mean, it's kind of in the name, this idea about being a war on cash. It's probably something a bit more like a cold war, you know, a slow war of attrition. But basically, I'm not the only person who uses this concept. There's quite a few people who use this concept. But the idea is that there are, rather than the move away from cash being an organic bottom-up process driven by ordinary people, the idea is that actually it's been as much pushed by top-down by players that have a commercial or political interest in degrading the cash system. Strangely enough, this puts me in a similar like camp to some like quite hardcore conspiracy theorist types who also argue similar things, but I've got a sort of different way of arguing about it. But the basic idea, the basic intuition that actually there are powerful players in society who wish to get rid of cash is pretty well known. It's like the mainstream media will never really talk about it the way that the mainstream media always talks about it. Like this issue, they always say, oh, you know, quote unquote, consumers are going cashless. So you'll see these, like, you see like all these news reports right now, consumers go cashless. There's never anything about like people are slowly pushed into the digital money ecosystem controlled by the banking sector. Mm. Like that's what it actually means. So this term cashless society actually means like, I don't actually use that term. I use the term the bankful society, right? It's like, what are you going into? You know, you're getting pushed into the private ecosystems controlled by the banking sector. And actually, once you start to look, I mean, like the war on cash is pretty damn like apparent. Like the Bank of America CEO like openly talks about it. Like he wants to get rid of cash. Like Visa openly talks about it. The Indian government has talked about it like so openly. Like this. So there's like a lot of players who like overtly talk about their desire to get rid of the cash system. And they all got different reasons for it. Maybe just one little like framing thing around this, though, is that part of what the war on cash is also about is around the privatization of the money system. All right. Because right now we've got a dual money system. So when, you know, when you're in the crypto world, people sort of generically talk about quote unquote fiat currency, right? They just sort of generically talk about it as if it's a single system. But actually, fiat currency is not a single system, as it's got multiple subsystems to it. And it's actually got multiple different circuits within the fiat currency world. And the sort of base circuit, as it were, is the sort of state money, of which there are two forms. One of which is physical, which we call cash, and that's the one we have access to. Then there's a second form, which is reserves, which you find at the central bank, and only banks can use that, right? But that's digital state money that banks have access to, but we don't, all right? So in our world, in the ordinary person's world, cash is actually the only form of state money you have access to. Then there's a world of digital bank deposits, which are the second form of fiat currency, and it's a separate form, and it's a separate system. And essentially, this is like banks issue that, right? This is privately issued promises issued by banks, which give you access to state money, right? And the sort of the general sort of like analogy I tend to use, or the metaphor I tend to use, is a bit is like, you know, imagine you're going to a casino and you carry a wadge of cash with you to the casino, and you walk up there and you're like, hey, please, can I have some chips? So you go to the cashier and they give you a bunch of chips, which are privately branded promises issued by the casino, which you can use within the casino ecosystem. All right. Those are physical chips, though. But imagine now if they were digital chips, right? And like digital chips are essentially what banks issue to us. So you go, you can give them state money. They will issue you private digital chips, which you then call your bank account, right? You say, oh, I got this money in my bank account. What you actually have is privately issued digital chips, which you can then move around within the private ecosystem controlled by the banking sector. So when we're talking about the war on cash, we're basically saying this world where the banks are increasingly kind of corralling people into their private ecosystems, and trying to get rid of that state form of money, the physical form of state money, in favor of a digital form of private bank money.
Yeah. So what I've found in like some of the from the right-wing framing on the war on cash is that is also in that, you know, we should have a right to physical cash, and that actually the government and big banks are forcing us to go digital. But at the same time, what they miss a lot of the time is that they're not acknowledging that cash is sort of like the nationalization of money, so to say. So would you say that it's like, so yeah, it is the privatization of like this nationalized.
Yeah, there's actually quite a sort of deep tension in libertarian, right-wing libertarian campaigning around this issue, because the reason why right-leaning libertarians also align with me on the war on cash, they also often agree that it's a bad thing, right? Which is good, because, you know, it's good to have cross-ideological agreement on an issue, because it makes it easier to campaign on it rather than having divisiveness. But they've got a different reason for it, right? So the reason why they think is that they think it's the state wants to surveil everybody, right? So because, of course, within right-leaning ideology, it's always the state that's seen as the main bogeyman. In left-leaning stuff, you tend to have more the corporate sector as being the people like tend to focus their attention on that, right? They're like, well, it's the banks who want this, right? Actually, in different situations, there are different players who want this. There are actually state interests and also commercial private player interests in destroying the cash system. But in general, the libertarian way of framing it is around state surveillance. And then insofar as they care about the banks, it's this idea that the banks are sort of state cronies. So banks are, you know, vilified insofar as they're seen as being agents of the state. Okay, so like...
Wild to me. Huh? It is wild to me.
Yeah, but then the interesting thing is that strangely then pushes libertarians into this position of saying, of supporting cash, which, as I mentioned, is actually the only form of public money we have. The private digital bank deposits is a privately issued form of money. So actually, in sort of like straightforward, like bog standard kind of like free market language or sort of right-leaning language, actually it should theoretically the sort of privately issued corporate money should be preferable, right?
Yeah.
But like, so there's a strange like tension there. But like, you know, I mean, libertarian ideology is quite flexible and dynamic in certain ways. So they can actually accommodate this and to say like, okay, well, we're just going to just whatever. It's like a privacy for preserving form of state money. And you know, incidentally, this is why the crypto world became so appealing to libertarians, because it's one of the ways you can resolve these sort of contradictions that you find in the thought. You can say like, okay, well, we want cash, but cash is state money. We don't like states. One way to resolve this is to talk about a form of digital cash that you can get, right? But so this is, you know, it's interesting that this is a cross ideological thing, and also of course in the sort of very like far right conspiracy theory world, there's a lot of this stuff around the sort of globalist cabal that wants to take over the world.
The lizard people.
Running, and then, like, I mean, I was recently featured on this conspiracy theory video where they took this video of me. They took a slice of a video when I was speaking in Sweden, and they put it into their own piece. And I there's me talking about the war on cash, and then, like, directly after it comes this, like, evangelical preacher who's talking about, like, the mark of the beast and, like, the sort of new world order. All right. So, like, it's kind of interesting that this is, I mean, I find it quite powerful in a way. I'm like, okay, well, at least we can work with this intuition that people have that, like, forms of centralized power can be negative, right? Or, like, and actually, like, even if you, like, there's like misidentification of, like, where the main source of that power is, it's still, like, a useful intuition to work with people with in this issue. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
Hope that made sense.
It's, I can imagine it can be a little bit annoying getting grouped in with some
It's not like people, a kind of a mark, badge of, like, achievement in some way.
That's know? True. Yeah, that's true. I can't wait till I get featured in the conspiracy theorist videos. But so then to expand a bit on that, would I just an observation that I've made recently, but like, you have these like Austrian economics types who are also have this idea of the war on cash, but from a different point of view, and that we should have cash because it also allows privacy. But then you have this sort of this class of libertarians who have achieved nirvana, and they say, actually, no, we need to have a real cash is completely market based. Like, I don't know if you know Erik Voorhees.
Yeah, sure.
He's a billionaire, or maybe near billionaire, CEO of Shapeshift, and there's this video he did where he talks about he can't wait till his children can finally use real money, or like market-based money, which I thought was interesting observation that he's probably a little bit more true to his principles in that sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, in libertarian circles, especially in, like, Austrian economics circles, I mean, in Austrian economics is the main sort of body of economics used by libertarians generally, amongst others. But, like, there is in a lot of the language and stuff, there's an implicit idea that the state and the market are separate.
Yeah.
Right? Among nuanced libertarians, it's understood that they're not. Like, nuanced libertarians will say, we understand that the state underpins property rights and underpins, like, contract systems, which then catalyze the ability for markets to actually work. And in the absence of that state, you have pirate markets, like, of, like, stateless regions, which actually are very, like, don't have economic development. They don't develop. You don't find huge, successful startup companies emerging from, you know, war-torn, stateless regions, right?
You haven't heard of that, the unicorn from Somalia?
Yeah, exactly. So this is the typical way people will be like, among the nuanced libertarians, they understand this idea that the state is the sort of underpinning base layer to enable a market to work. But then the main thing in libertarian ideology is like, well, we want the state to underpin property rights and contract law, but we don't want it to do anything else beyond that. All right, this is like a sort of like minarchist idea that if you zone into the realm of like anarcho-capitalists, they sort of like start to imagine like there being no base layer infrastructure for markets, but then somehow markets producing their own base layer infrastructure. So people will be paid to like provide security and contract law, and they can be paid in a form of money that somehow like transcends law. All right. So like this idea that basically like there is and this is why, you know, libertarians often fetishize gold, because there's a sort of mythology around gold that it will always be seen as valuable regardless of your political situation. So it's a form. It has this like mystical power, which even if you have no state, you will suddenly just like act and use your labor in response to gold. Okay, somebody dangles some gold in front of you, and then you'll give them a service, right? So you dangle gold in front of somebody, and then they're like, I will protect you, all right? I will offer you, like, police services. Of course, like, I mean, like, the kind of, like, sort of conceptual problem, of course, is that like if somebody is like in a position to offer you like security services or police services, they're probably just going to steal your gold from you. This, so like anarcho-capitalism and this stuff always like breaks down on this point. But the basic idea, like in Eric Voorhees' world, is this idea that states and markets are separate. And therefore, the ultimate pure money is some kind of like market-based stateless money, which has never really existed other than in very small-scale situations. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I've worked on many pre-crypto alternative currency projects, which are, technically speaking, stateless. You're taking a community group, and you're saying, hey, within this community group, we can issue forms of money, right? But basically, this idea of, you know, that works at a very small scale. But the stuff that people at Voorhees want is this like transnational stateless money at a huge scale, which we've never, ever seen before in the history of humankind.
Yeah.
Even gold doesn't have that characteristics. You know, gold is like controlled by monarchs historically. Anyway, I'm kind of going off on like, you know, a tangent. But yes, within that sort of thinking, they're imagining this form of money that can transcend human politics.
Mm-hmm. So you have in your framework and your theory around the war on cash, where exactly does cryptocurrency fit in all this in comparison to like pieces of data in a bank's database to represent money?
Well, you know, actually the history of cryptocurrency is partly, if you look back at the old sort of cypherpunk movements, one of the chief concerns actually was financial privacy, right? And actually, and this potential for a future, you know, cashless society or whatever, bankful society, which I would say, people like David Chaum were already in like early 1980s were writing about this, saying, hey, if we do go to a system, you know, there's a rise of the digital world was occurring, the internet was being built and stuff. It'd be like, if they were looking ahead and saying, shit, this is like, it could be like really dystopian, right? If we have everybody within these centralized or at least oligopoly type of systems, right? Which is how the current monetary system works. And so a lot of the early development around crypto came out of this prediction around cashless society stuff. And I mean, so that's one immediate point to say, like, and if you want to try and position, the way I would normally frame this is that I sort of started off by saying we've got a dual monetary system. We have a state part to it and there's a private bank part to it. All right. And those work in combination with each other. And right now our options are state physical money and bank digital. Okay. Now there's lots of like other things that emerge when you start to say like, could we have state digital money? Okay. There's a whole debate right now going on about that. And by that, what they mean is like state digital money issued to ordinary people. Okay. You can also say, could we have a non-state, non-bank form of digital money, right? And that's where the crypto world has tried to fit in. It says like, we are creating this non-state, non-bank digital unit you can move around. And, you know, all the sort of technicalities of crypto are like how you do that. The main failure has been that it hasn't really operated as money at all. And actually, if you want to take one step further in this trajectory, when you hybridize the crypto architecture with the fiat money architecture, you get into the world of stable coins, all right, which are essentially promises issued for fiat money that circulate in an unregulated decentralized market. And so that's actually an authentically new development that's come from the sort of hybridization of the crypto world with the fiat currency world. So I guess the state of play right now is you got state physical money, bank digital money, a debate around state digital money for ordinary people, or central bank digital currencies, a ongoing debate about Bitcoin and stuff like that, which has gone on for like 10 years, and then like a new debate around stable coins, which actually do look like they could be quite disruptive in the sense of like being seen as real money by a lot of people. So that's where the crypto world sort of fits in. And stuff like Libra are just like, you know, like the big Facebook currency. These were all like iterations on a theme, you know, like just new iterations on one or more of those parts.
Yeah, it's, I mean, just the past few years, at least to me, it seems like it's really just like taking something and like small little tweaks over time that have happened pretty quickly. And I mean, the past 10 years, things have changed quite a bit from Bitcoin to now stable currencies, you're saying, and now to talk about CBDCs or central bank digital currencies.
Yeah. And I mean, and even within that category of central bank digital currencies, you got different ways of implementing that particular thing. So you could actually have a crypto type version of that or else not. So like, those are the main subcategories right now of
debate. Yeah, that's true.
Like, and the Bitcoin world still goes on around in like circles largely. I mean, it's been going on for like, I mean, I was involved in the early Bitcoin community in London, and like the same things are basically said over and over again for like years. It seems like almost like a millenarian cult, you know, like a kind of like a cargo cult waiting for like a salvation and sort of getting really rich in the meantime. So that's been kind of like, sort of like funny and yet sort of sad at the same time to sort of like see how the Bitcoin community largely hasn't moved forward often in like its actual understanding of monetary systems or and it's kind of like devolved into this sort of like, you know, mosh pit of speculation and like backstabbing and stuff like that. In the early days, it actually was pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. The drama of the Bitcoin world is a fun one.
It's dull. I mean, I find it dull as hell.
I mean, just like I think I have just like a guilty pleasure sometimes about
it. It's like a soap opera. It's like watching a sitcom. It's like goes around in circles, like Days of Our Lives. You know, whether it's like The Bold and the Beautiful, it's just like watching the same theme just repeat itself over and over again.
Yeah. So thinking about this framework again, I was curious on your thoughts now that there's sort of it's already started, but like this mix of this of cryptocurrency and sort of the corporate world, with now very recently the announcements that PayPal and Venmo will also begin allowing for crypto transactions, and you can buy and sell your crypto and send your crypto to your friends through PayPal and through Venmo. So I was curious about what your thoughts on that are.
I don't really have any like very well developed thoughts on that. I mean, basically people like, you know, these guys are businesses, right? Like if they can make money by offering some service, then they will. Like
maybe like 5 or so years ago, I mean, there was the PayPal CEO was like, no, we'll never touch it. And then, you've seen it. You've seen the shifts.
If you want to understand like capitalist organizations, I mean, I'm sure you do, you know, like it's like they will, you know, like a PayPal and crew will be like initially say something and then change their mind. They're fickle. You know, if there's profit to be had, they will go after it. Like that's how like corporates work. So I don't actually like know precisely why they've now decided and what exactly the new service entails. Maybe you can give me some more detail on it, because it's quite recent news, right? They're just like, on my PayPal account, I'll be able to hold a balance, or like,
as far as I understand, I mean, I think what I imagine is that they're doing a similar thing as what Coinbase already has. Mm-hmm. It's just that Coinbase only does crypto, and I think really, I mean, I guess for me, if I were to describe it, it's just sort of like this ongoing sort of the neoliberalization of cryptocurrency. Because I mean, I would argue that cryptocurrency isn't inherently neoliberal, but the neoliberal actors want a piece of the pie, and I think that's just sort of what's.
But I think it's important to, like, in the early crypto community, the way that bank involvement and stuff was framed was very much like, banks will try to defend themselves by either attacking this or by trying to co-opt it in some kind of way. So there's a lot of sort of conspiratorial tones around this idea that some other banks were going to be under threat. And the banks really are not under threat by this. There's been no significant disruption of the banking sector as well as a result of this. So insofar, and PayPal and these guys are built on top of the banking sector, so they're basically part of the same overarching system. Okay. So insofar as they engage with it, they engage because they have a profit motive, and they say like, well, we can maybe like facilitate, people see this as an investment asset, and we'll like offer a, you know, in my PayPal accounts, I currently have like, you know, US dollar promises. Well, US dollars, you say. Yeah. But now I can also add another like part of it that will now be able to have like easily access crypto, units of crypto. And of course, like, interestingly, when you look at people like Eric Voorhees, you know, on the one hand, like they're like supposedly hardline libertarians, but on the other hand, they'll like very quickly enter into deals with these big, like massive corporates, right? Which have like state support half the time. So like, there's always this like ambiguity around like, you know, the commercialization of crypto, as it were. So like on the one hand, there's all this like angst that sort of that the community, if you hang around in the Bitcoin community and stuff, there's a lot of like, kind of like hand-wringing and angst around the co-optation of crypto. And yet within libertarian ideology, there's also the promotion of self-interest as a prime motivator, in which case it becomes very hard for them to sort of say, we condemn the entrepreneurs who sell out to corporations, all right, because they're following their self-interest. So, you know, it's like, it's hard to like go and diss some entrepreneur who's gone and sold his crypto project to some big corporate, because it's like, well, he's acting as a private actor on the market, and that's what he's supposed to do, right? Sell out to the corporations. Like, so there's always this like sort of angst in the crypto world of like, are you supposed to like take on the banks, or are you supposed to sell to the banks, or are you supposed to like, and, you know, sorry, that's a bit of like a long rambling thing, but like, this is a,
I agree with your ramble, though.
It's part of that. It's part of that ongoing Days of Our Lives soap opera that gets reported on in that, you know. But that said, you know, I'm sounding very jaded around crypto right now. But like, there are like authentically exciting parts of it, and you're totally right. There are like really subversive elements in crypto that could have like really sort of empowering potentials. But like when I see stuff like PayPal and Venmo offering this, I don't see anything particularly profound, right? Because they're just entering the market to facilitate like this idea of crypto investment, where which is not about establishing a new monetary system. It's about speculating on an asset, right? And you know, I've still use crypto to like do transactions and stuff. It's not like I'm like, don't use it, but like, yeah, there's just like so much bullshit when you hang around the community where people are like imagining that. I actually don't know what the crypto community's response to PayPal and Venmo getting involved is yet. I'll have to go and see.
Yeah, I would imagine it's mixed. I mean, from what I've seen, people are like, yeah, now there's like more mainstream adoption. This is what we need to see. And the other side is like, what do you mean? This is supposed to be our little project is supposed to be our thing, guys. Like, we're supposed to get away from.
And also, bear in mind, I mean, like, in the crypto world, there's this constant cognitive dissonance between the idea of something like Bitcoin being money and something like Bitcoin being an investment. All right. Yeah. And like, I've spoken quite a lot about this cognitive dissonance where, you know, money is something you use to price other things in, right? When you see a unit of money, you're supposed to think about other things. You're supposed to think about what you can get for that money. That's what makes money money. Is it like you don't see it as being something in and of itself? You conceptualize the goods and like your desires and dreams when you look at it, right? Whereas like something that is not money, you for example, like this microphone that I have, or like the whatever, like these speakers and so on around me, my desk. When I look at them, I don't think about other things. I think about them in and of themselves. I think about the speakers and the sound quality that comes out of them. I think about that kind of stuff, right? Because they are like not money. They're objects in and of themselves, all right? And I price them in money. So when I think about their resale value, I'll be like, I wonder how much money I could get for these speakers if I resell them. Okay, so I either think about them in and of themselves, or I think about their resale value, but I never like think about, you know, groceries when I look at my speakers. Okay.
Yeah.
Whereas with money, that's what you're supposed to think about. It's the unit of account for all the other goods in society, right? So like you go and you when you see your wadge of cash in your wallet or the deposits in your bank account, you're thinking to yourself, what could I spend this on, right? Now, when you come to the crypto world, you've got to ask yourself this question, and a lot of crypto people don't want to ask themselves this question. You say, when you look at your crypto, what do you think about? do you think about its resale value or do you think about other goods? And for most people, they're thinking about its resale value, which means it is not money. It is a good priced in money. It's what they're thinking of as what they call an investment right now, which is like, I buy this object and then I try to resell it for money later. And this is like the, you know, the sort of the dark secret, the dark skeleton hidden in the closet of so many of these crypto communities is this pretense of a monetary revolution, which is actually just an attempt to make speculative fiat currency profits. Okay. No. And even people like Eric Voorhees and stuff, who like for all their like sort of you know, railing against the fiat money system, are, you know, become super wealthy in fiat money, right? And like that's considered a success. And the last thing I'll say about that is that like to be able to reconcile that cognitive dissonance requires a certain view on what money is. And this is where Austrian economics comes to the rescue of a lot of like libertarians. They say like, oh, well, money is like simultaneously an investment and this like exchange medium. All right. And like the only way you can hold that contradiction in your head is to start believing that money is just like any other object. Right. And so this is where, I mean, we can talk about that later, maybe, but like, yeah, no, I get so pissed off with this like ambiguity or this like lazy, like this lazy sort of calling it money.
Super lazy. But I think in a Marxist terms, at least how I understand, is that it's basically the difference between money having exchange value and like goods having a use value. It's kind of
yeah, for sure. Although, you know, Marxist theories of money are ambiguous as well.
Yeah, which is what I wanted to ask you next, actually, because in a recent interview that you did for Consensus Distributed, you mentioned that you yourself don't adhere to a commodity theory of money, which is, Marx uses a sort of commodity theory of money as well as a lot of cryptocurrency enthusiasts. So I was curious if you can maybe elaborate a bit on your non-Marxist theory of money.
Yeah, I mean, look, like the Marxist world is actually, you know, it has something in common with and I say this cautiously because there are differences in the way that money is conceived, but just generically, when you're looking at classical economics from which Marx comes, right, like draws on like Adam Smith as for a lot of the sort of political economy stuff he was doing. And all those guys were using commodity theories of money, right? They were like saying, you know, like money is a commodity. The reason we value it is it's a commodity, and it's like a special commodity. It's like a special commodity that will then become this kind of like universal exchange media. And you look into Austrian economics, they use this like bizarre sort of thought experiment, which they call the regression theorem, which sort of does this as well. It's like a kind of ahistorical thought experiment, which you can sort of like, you imagine like a useful object and then you imagine it kind of like sort of becoming a universal exchange media. And this is actually like not that different from how many Marxists think about money, actually. Albeit, I'm sure those two groups would like vehemently deny that this is a similarity. But the basic deal about commodity theories of money is that, well, number one, you imagine that money comes from something. So you say, I have money, like there is money from something, right? And to get this money, you have to go and produce it, right? I must go and like find it somewhere, all right? I have to like exert energy into like obtaining it, right? And then in the Marxist framework, that this gets put into the labor theory of value. But you don't have to see it like that. But like basically the idea is like you got to produce money. And once you've produced it, you then use it to induce other people to give things to you. All right. So you're holding this object of value and then you like dangle it in front of somebody and you say, hey, look at this dangling object of value. Can I induce you to give up one of your objects of value for me for this money? Right. So essentially they see it as some kind of like elaborate form of barter. And this is like what commodity theories of money assume. Like you produce the money, you use it to induce people to give you something. And often the money is perpetual. It just sort of will like keep on like floating around like forever until it decays. Okay. So you're just imagining it's just another object. Now, if you like go into the opposite school of thought of money, firstly, it denies that money comes from something. right? The idea is that money comes from nothing, okay, which is often a scaremongering line used among commodity theorists. They say, like, fiat money comes from nothing. It's you know, magicked out of thin air. All right. But within credit theories, like, this is like taken for granted. It's like, yes, of course, this is what money is, right? It's not an object. It's a system of accounting. So by default, of course, it's magicked out of air. All right. It's like, that's what a sort of like a system of credit is. Okay. So the first thing about like credit theory is like money comes from nothing, but it takes the form of promises. Okay. So essentially you issue promises. And the key insight in credit theories of money is that you can pay people by issuing promises. All right. Okay. And this is like what will be called IOUs. So if you're coming from commodity theories, you imagine you first have to have value in your hand before somebody will give you something. Whereas credit theories say, I don't have to have anything in my hand before somebody gives me something. I can issue them a promise and they will give me that thing. And if they believe in my promise and they can objectify that promise as a unit, that promise can become a monetary form. Okay. And there's different versions of these promises that exist. And the main sort of intuition when you like look in sort of state theories of money is that very powerful players are the ones who are best able to issue those promises and for their promises to be accepted. Okay. So if you look at the theories of money called like chartalism, they say the state is uniquely positioned to issue money because it's a powerful player, right? So its promises are widely accepted. Banks can issue these as well, right? So, but credit theories of money extend beyond states and banks. I mean, you can have it among friends. You can say, I issue you an IOU, and maybe like we agree that this is like a real thing between us, and you got an obligation at some point to give me something back, right? So I can call on that promise. All right. And then the monetary system is essentially the system of recording and transferring those promises around. Okay. I mean, if you work in a bank, this is like straightforward and obvious. Yeah. That's exactly what the entire database system of banks is ways of issuing promises and moving them around. Right. But it comes as news to lots of people.
So then to me, it sounds like it's more about the power relation or power hierarchy in a sense, and how you create, like, whether or not something is money, like if there is some sort of like there's a little bit of an authoritarian nature to it, almost, if you want money, at least at like a grand scale.
Sure. Yeah. And there's no nobody in credit theories of money is trying to claim that there's not huge power dynamics. I mean, that's precisely how the money system works, is through gigantic power dynamics and actually like network effects. So like libertarians have this like quite crude way of putting it. They'll say the state uses violence, forces you through violence to accept its money, right? Like almost like it's an alien invader that sort of like floats down to the planet and like points a gun at you and says, you're going to have to use this, right? But like, what is the state though? The state is an organic structure that cannot exist without the people that make it up, right? I mean, even like Thomas Hobbes and people like grasp the idea of like the Leviathan as being this like entity that's made up of the people that construct it, right? Like if you look at like the old like books on like Thomas Hobbes and stuff, the opening picture is of this like gigantic like monarch made up of other people, all right? And this is like actually a much more intuitive, real version of what the state is. Like, fine, it has particular people you can identify as being on the top echelons, but actually it derives its power from the people that constitute it. It doesn't derive its power from an external energy source like an alien invader would, right? So actually its ability to coerce is limited, and it can actually be pacified by the people who inhabit it, which is what the story of democracy is, right? Like people within a state will slowly like pacify this construction that they've created or have been like under, right? And this is like what, you know, all that our politics revolve around, right? So yeah, like in that sense, money is like, okay, in a crude sense, underpinned by violence. But in reality, what it's really underpinned by is like partially violence, but like largely like coercive network effects. The idea that you're all locked into a interdependent mesh that you cannot escape and have been born into and have no idea what's outside of, right? So like, I can sort of intellectually say something and like go out into the street and shout stuff about that the money system's not real, but nobody cares, because to everybody it's very, very real, and it's the only way you can access the things you need for your survival. And you really don't need like military troops wandering up and down the streets, like pointing guns at you for you to reuse this. You have to use it because everyone else is using it, right? Like, and in that sense, that's an extremely powerful credit system. And one of the like the bizarre things you find in libertarian circles is the idea that a commodity money would be more powerful than this huge network structure. But it's like, why would like random pieces of gold be more powerful than a network of 350 million people? All right. Like the strength of networks is never to be underestimated. They're, you know, super powerful. Mm. So and I think this is like credit theories of money are often like sort of dissed by commodity theorists as being like, you know, sham money or fraud money. You know, it's like, oh, this like Ponzi money issued by these like, you know, tin pot players. And I'm like, Jesus, like, no. Have you seen the power of these network systems? It's incredible. All right. So like there's a lot of like straw manning and underestimating the power of credit money systems in crypto. Yeah. Anyway, that's my rant.
Hey guys, I just wanted to chime in for a second and remind you that if you are enjoying the interview, then please take a minute to open up your phone or wherever you're listening to and leave a 5-star review. It really helps with the search engine optimization and makes sure that the podcast gets showed to other people. As well, if you really want to help out, you can provide help financially. So I have a Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/theblockchainsocialist, you can donate either $3, $6, or $10 a month to help out with the costs that I have to pay for myself in order to host the podcast and host the website. So right now at the moment, I pay a little bit more than I receive in my Patreon donations. So any amount really helps. And with that donation, you receive some special accesses to special posts that are Patreon exclusive, as well as extra privileges in the Discord group. But that's it from me. That's all I wanted to say. So let's get back to the interview with Brett Scott. But so then, knowing this, I'm curious to hear then what exactly would be, I mean, I don't even know if this is even possible, like what would be the properties of like the perfect money for you?
Well, look, there is no perfect money. And actually, weirdly, over the years, because I've been involved in financial activism and stuff for a long time, I always get emails from like cranky, like normally like these old dudes email me with their visions of perfect money. And they're like, I've worked out the formula for like the world's perfect money. And inevitably they're like formerly an engineer who worked like, I don't know, in the oil industry or something. And they've got like engineering skills and they love the world. I mean, I'm kind of like making it a bit cruder than it actually is, but like they often imagine that monetary systems are sort of technological engineering systems and yeah. that they're currently poorly designed, right? And therefore, you know, it's like, how could we be using these poorly designed systems? And I've made a much better design and surely everybody should see that my design should naturally take over. And I have this mathematical equation to show, you know, the optimal amount of money in the economy and so on. And it's like, why is this relevant? It's got nothing to do with how monetary systems work. You know, monetary systems are not engineering problems. They're like huge political systems, right? And sort of giant network political systems with like political power is behind like how this works. Like that's where you make innovations in the money system. There is a technology element to it, but it's like one of the sort of smallest elements. So that's why I'm very shy of, I'd be very wary of saying I have some perfect money system. But what I would say is that the drive to try and decentralize the power in the monetary system is a very laudable goal, because absolutely the monetary system forms the base layer for how the entire capitalist system works, right? So if you're interested in like the general problems of capitalist systems, like social inequality, ecological destruction, you know, existential disconnection from reality, then thinking about that base layer of the money system is very important and like a very beautiful thing to do. And in this sense, I'm actually been, you know, with the traditional crypto community and being like, there's a lot of creativity in trying to like experiment with various tokens and stuff. But obviously, as you can tell, I've been very frustrated by the waste of energy and sort of waste of like creative talent that's gone into like dead ends in crypto. So like looking forward, the stuff I'm finding super interesting is, you know, I just went on that rant about credit money versus commodity money. What I would love to see is a hybridization of using like sort of crypto architectures and decentralized architectures with the credit money, the intuitions around sort of credit theories of money, right? So like you can start to make some really interesting forms of money like that. And so like the types of projects that I follow right now in crypto are things like trust lines, circles is another one, these various experimentations with how you issue essentially IOU systems on decentralized architectures. I can go into those more if you want me to, but like
Sure. What exactly, because I think what a request that I get a lot is they always tell me, like, I get messages about what are the crypto projects that are trying to create socialism, and like, you know, what, how can, if we just make a cryptocurrency that's actually just labor vouchers, and we would make the perfect socialist money. And that's something I get a lot. I'm always like, I don't know the answer, and I can't tell you what is right and what is wrong. But I do think that there is value, and it's, you know, interesting to know what other people are doing.
So like, look, on the left wing crypto stuff, I mean, that's kind of like what it says it in Blockchain Socialist, right? Like, but there's been, I mean, it's been a very small part of the crypto community historically, although there is crossover. I mean, you know, in libertarian, you know, I'm sort of like being quite like, you know, like making some sort of blunt statements about libertarianism, but obviously libertarianism is a sort of a more rich tradition than just like some of the crude forms of conservative reactionary libertarianism that you see, right? There is a lot of like traditions of like left-leaning anarchism and even like hybrids and blends between, I mean, right now, for example, you're seeing people like Glenn Weil, the sort of like radical markets community who are trying to do these forms of hybridization between sort of market thinking and communitarian thinking, right? So like there is a lot of like interesting, let's say like unformed ideological space in crypto, which actually sort of transcends like the traditional left-right boundaries. And I think that's super interesting. It's a bit like, it's like stem cells. Am I getting that analogy right? Those like cells that haven't yet like figured out where they're going.
No, I mean, right. just to make this comment, I think absolutely like the space of kind of like post-capitalists in the crypto space who are a bit, who pretend like they're unideological, I think is a really important space for the left to be in and to like push and like provide some influence for them.
Yeah, you got it totally right there. I mean, the post-capitalist, I mean, what is post-capitalism? I mean, it's basically like it doesn't have any characteristics really, right? But it's an intuition. It's an attempt at, you know, if crudely speaking, capitalism is like the thesis, then you have anti-capitalism as its antithesis. And then post-capitalism is this attempt at synthesis, right? It's like this kind of like, you know, and in that sort of post-capitalist space, you have all the talk around creative commons, open source, peer production, collaborative economy. There's all these kind of like sort of like semi-hybrid forms that exist that are all sort of generically lumped under there. And that's a very interesting space because it's quite creative, right? And it's actually brings together people who have quite disparate ideological backgrounds. And I do think that's where one area that crypto really excels right now is being in that space and sort of offering those like that opportunity for experimentation. Because after all, I mean, let's look at early Bitcoin. What are the two? There's actually two contradictory components to early Bitcoin. Well, not necessarily contradictory, but like they're often presented as being one. But basically, it was said to be decentralized, all right? But then it was also this, like, sound money, all right? Now, sound money, this idea of, like, fixed money supplies and commodity-like money is, like, very overtly a right-wing ideology, okay? Whereas decentralization isn't actually inherently like any particular, there's actually a lot of different political traditions that will draw on that idea of decentralization, including, for example, cooperatives and communitarian like initiatives, like also like libertarian socialism, who will say like, actually, we want these forms of like collaboration at scale and stuff like that, right? But the early Bitcoin community sort of like took those two things to be one and the same. Like we're gonna have a collectively issued right-wing form of money, all right? But actually, there's nothing like inherent to like blockchains that says like that has to be the only way you do it, right? There's actually a lot of like potential to say like, okay, we could do like hypothetically like a worker-owned co-op using a blockchain architecture, right, where you actually have the whole thing distributed like a distributed Uber or something like that, right, which gives workers more rights and gives them more power. And that's the sort of communitarian reading of blockchain.
That's an Ava co-op.
Cool. Yeah. But within the money space, has actually been where the sort of a left-leaning kind of stuff hasn't excelled as much. And actually, right now in the money space, I'm like most interested in sort of mutual credit systems and how they could be, you can make crypto versions of mutual credit systems, which I could elaborate more on, but it depends on where you want to take this.
Well, I think now would be a good time since I wanted to go through a couple of interesting tidbits from your last book that I think sort of, I mean, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are now, like 7 or 8 years later, on a couple of the things, especially this one here. So in your book, towards somewhere in the end, you have a very small subsection about Bitcoin and how there is like this importance of underground hype for certain currencies, and you use Bitcoin as like a really good example. So I thought it was really interesting that only 5 years or so after Bitcoin had been created, and it was really like up and coming and in like very, very small circles. But you mentioned that currencies don't need not only good design principles, but also a sense of underground hype to charge them with psychological power and soul. And you said Facebook and Gmail understood this, initially promoting themselves via closed peer groups, creating a sense that one was missing out by not using them. That can be the first step to going viral. Yeah. So I was curious on, does that still fit within your theory of money? I don't know if there was necessarily underground hype for most state monies, but
yeah, look, I mean, that's, I guess, the point going back to these debates we're having around. Look, I mean, what is cryptocurrency? If you coldly look at it, they're digital objects, all right, that you can move around, at least Bitcoin. And that's all you can really say about it. And I mean, like, the way I often speak about this is like, you know, imagine I had a bowl of glass marbles, right? And then I turn those into a digital form, all right? And I could sort of move this featureless digital object around, all right? Like, that's what crypto tokens originally were, like featureless digital objects that could be moved around in a network of people, right? You could, a group of strangers could use a common protocol to issue tokens and move them around, right? But those tokens essentially had nothing beyond being a token. They're just like, it's an object, okay? Now, if you think of yourself, like, how do I make a random object into a monetary system? Then that's a very difficult task, okay? Like, it's one thing, that's why I initially would never call these things cryptocurrency. I call them crypto tokens, right? Because they're not currencies until they're actually used as currencies, right? Initially, they're just these objects. And in the absence of having a state issue these things or having a powerful, monetary circuit that will sort of underpin your system, you really need these forms of hype. And that's what the thing I was talking about there. And actually, the hype of Satoshi was one of the key things that enabled these digital objects. And I remember being in the early community, and they used to be like, nobody knew what these things were. They'd be like, oh, these are kind of these cool like things, units. You go to people, you'd be like, hey, do you want some Bitcoin? And they'd be like, well, what is it? And you're like, oh, it's this, it's a digital object, it's a thing. And they're like, okay, well, yeah, well, what, like, what? Like, it's like going up to somebody with like a piece of blank piece of paper and saying, do you want this thing? Like, look at this cool thing I got, right? And they're like, yeah, well, what is it? And it's like, it's a blank piece of paper. And they're like, well, why did I take this blank piece of paper? And it's like, because there's only like a few of them. You take that, it's cool. It's like, you know, there was no like features you could really speak about other than the fact that you could move them around without a central party.
The limited supply aspect in a part of that as well? I can imagine.
Yeah, that sort of like became a talking point, right? Like the limited supply supposedly gave the blank object something, right? But like, you know, I could have a limited supply of like blank pieces of paper. It doesn't do anything, right? Like it's, you know, like this became part of the sort of official like ideology or sort of mysticism around cryptocurrency, was this mythical limited supply. But I mean, like, you know, and how do you know the supply is limited? I mean, it's arbitrary. It's an arbitrary number that was chosen for what the limited supply is. Like, it's, you know, it could have been 500 million or it could have been 5,000. I mean, like, it's totally arbitrary. This sort of the only thing that was sort of known about it was that like it was had a predictable schedule of issuance. So actually, this is what a lot of people were speaking about when they were saying it had a limited supply. What they really meant was it has a predictable issuance schedule. Okay. Yeah. And actually, it's a really weird number to have chosen, just like incidentally, like 21 million. I mean, it's like such a weird. Think about this. If you want to talk about like the inequality in these systems, right? Imagine you're a designer of a currency system and you're like, I'm going to issue 21 million units, but then I'm going to give the rewards for its initial issuance out in 50 unit chunks. Okay. Now, how many like people are in the world? There's like, you know, 8 billion people. All right. And you're imagining in some hypothetical equal distribution of this currency, if you had to take 21 million and it would divide that by 8 billion, you end up with like tiny fragments of bitcoins, right? Each person in the world was getting an equal amount, right? So an equal distribution would be tiny fragments of this unit, and yet it was given out in 50 unit chunks, all right? Like from the very beginning, it was saying like, we like want a small group of people to become insanely wealthy off these tokens, right? I hope that makes sense. Like,
yeah, no, but I think, I mean, I don't, that either, it either tells that, or I think it might also tell that, I mean, when Satoshi or whoever was making this, they didn't have the vision that this would be a global thing.
I'm being cynical. Actually, if I was taking the side of Satoshi, I mean, I've read the white paper many times. It's a very beautiful piece of it's a very elegant piece of writing, and it's a very elegant sort of design, right? But it's extremely naive from a monetary perspective. It's this idea that, you know, so that's what I'm saying. So in the early community, you're like, okay, how do we mystify these objects? And you created this whole incentive structure where you're getting given these big chunks of the overall supply, of the imagined future supply. You've been given like huge amounts of them at the upfront, in the hope that at some point it becomes adopted as a global currency, at which point you're going to become insanely wealthy, right? Yeah. And that's part of the incentive structure that sort of became part of like how it was pitched. But the initial story around Satoshi was a very important element of this, right? You needed this sort of mythical founder who was like sort of sat there. And actually, there are a lot of people in the crypto community who now sort of refer to this as like the immaculate conception, right? This like unattached person, you don't know who they are, goes in and I remember I was speaking at the Bitcoin Cash conference in Tokyo like a couple of years ago. The sort of opening Bitcoin Cash was called Satoshi's Vision Conference. And I remember I was at this bar and Craig Wright was there, and he was like, I think he might have been pretty drunk, I don't know, but he was like, I had this like moment of being like, you know what, like the reason why we don't want to know who Satoshi is that like as soon as you pin it to a real world person who's like taking a piss in the urinals and is like, you know, like talking loudly or is like whatever, maybe regardless of whether they're like a nice guy or not, like it suddenly attaches all this interpersonal politics to the person, right? And Ethereum has had this, you know, with like Vitalik, like it's the personal politics gets attached to him and what he says, rather than like in Bitcoin, where actually there was a sort of this entity that just sort of like floated there as this like saint. And I think that was very powerful in Bitcoin, was this like not only the incentive structure, but also like the sort of mysticism that was generated around this sort of this founder. But it has subsequently failed to actually like really create the types of economic circuits that a state can create, all these like credit money systems can create. So yeah. I would update my book now by saying, you know, like you can, it has it succeeded in a marginal sense as becoming a sort of quasi money, but it hasn't really succeeded beyond that.
No, I think we can agree there. Speaking of things that maybe you would rewrite in your book, just because I have this quote, I think is very funny. You mentioned, so with most consumption goods, the value goes down fairly rapidly. The value of a toilet paper gradually depreciates to zero. Do you think were you thinking about the coronavirus during that time? You're writing that?
Well, but it's true though. Like with even in Corona, as you use up the toilet roll, it depreciates pretty quickly. But, you know, one thing I would change there is I don't refer to money as having value. Actually, that's true. The toilet paper is like actual value, and it literally disappears into nothing. It's not that it has. I'll take that back.
I mean, I guess as long as you're not, you don't have a toilet paper shortage like some people have maybe in the past.
Yeah.
So, one of the last things from your book I wanted to talk about, because I think on the left, we tend to have this problem, I think, in being able to approach spaces that traditionally the left is either not involved in or is a space that is already dominated by sort of establishment or like right wingers. So, I mean, cryptocurrency especially is a space where the left really does not like to get close to. There tends to be like a really strong knee-jerk reaction at certain times when cryptocurrency is brought up in left-wing circles.
Yeah,
and that's a shame, I think, because while there is plenty to criticize, I think I would like to think if any of the you know famous Marxists of the past were alive today, they wouldn't just
for sure.
Take the time to analyze it. So, I mean, in this book, you mention the person who dislikes computers will never be a computer hacker. And it seems like an obvious thing. Like if you, you know, if you say you don't like computers just as because you're not, you know, of one, because you're not like, you know, you don't wear glasses, therefore you don't like to, you don't like to read or something, then of course if you have that idea in your head, you're never going to approach it.
Yeah,
and you're always just going to dismiss it, and then you'll never read or something. So I was curious what your advice is or your thoughts on how, say for example, if you are a socialist and you right now have a knee-jerk reaction towards cryptocurrency, how would you go about approaching these spaces?
Yeah, but I mean, in the Heretics Guide to Global Finance, which is my old book, which came out 2013, you know, like it was actually written in response to the publishers asked me to write it for Occupy after the Occupy Wall Street protests, where it was realized that many activists really didn't know what they were talking about, or you know, had an intuitive feeling of repulsion at what the financial sector would do, but didn't have a way of articulating what their actual concerns were. And it wasn't even just down to like, you know, finance is technical and full of jargon. It was almost like a cultural repulsion or a lack of desire to actually learn. And actually, this is like a slightly darker, you know, things being technical is like one reason why people don't learn stuff. But another reason is like I feel some sort of like lack of resonance culturally with it. But actually, if you want to like really get into the sort of arts of what, you know, I was calling that book sort of financial hacking, you got to kind of like dirty yourself a bit. You got to kind of like get into the spirit of systems. Otherwise, you're always going to be on the outside. All right. And you're going to be throwing rocks at it from the outside, but not always sort of being somewhat on the back foot. And it's a controversial line that I was taking there. I was saying, you know, activists should get a lot more like stuck in the weeds of like how these systems work and like actually try to like be, I use a controversial term here, like empathetic to these systems, you know, actually suspend disbelief a bit, actually go in and be a little bit open, right? You know, and I've been ranting a lot to, you know, in this interview about, you know, crypto and stuff and some of the shortcomings, but actually it's always, I've always tried to be open and to go in and try and like listen to what people say. And, you know, I've developed my critiques from the fact that I've actually been immersing myself in those systems, right? Rather than just like reading critiques. And it's often, this is also why I'm, you know, now I'm starting to get into position to actually start to advocate for alternative forms of that same thing, right? And I'm not the only person. There are other sort of left-leaning people in the crypto space who are now finding each other and saying, okay, we've been exploring the space for a while. We see the limitations of the typical sort of like the bog standard libertarian stuff. And now we're going to start making something much more interesting. All right. And that's where the real creativity starts to like get unleashed, is when you start to have people who are like kind of both in and out of a system, you know, like they sort of like, which is what, you know, I called that book, The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance. And the reason why I chose the term heretic was I was arguing that like an old sort of like Christian dogma, you know, the heretic was a much more threatening figure than somebody who didn't believe or who came from a different religion. All right. Because the heretic was both an insider and an outsider at the same time. The heretic was somebody who took elements of a religion and then sort of like changed it or altered sort of points of doctrine. And this is why they were so persecuted. It's like they're much more threatening figures because they don't, they could actually like win over like, and you get the point. So actually this notion of like the heretic in these systems is like you try to have some part of yourself open to it whilst also like bending stuff. So in the case of crypto, it is like very useful. I mean, I wish when I went to Bitcoin events, which I often do, there were more like people there who were not just like, you know, the typical like, you know, Murray Rothbard quoting like the libertarianism 101 adherent, you know, like I want to see like more like people who are coming in from like different angles. And there are people like that, but there are far too few of those people. And so, but beyond crypto, I mean, this is something I would still advocate for like all systems, you know, whether it's like Silicon Valley tech bros or whether it's like, you know, the mainstream finance system. All of these systems need people in them who are like trying to figure out how they can be co-opted towards more kind of communitarian ends, right? And towards sort of more holistic ends. And, you know, like the last thing I'll say about that is that like, I didn't like advocate that like everybody has to go and like embed themselves in a bank or embed themselves in a crypto firm or like have to become like, you know, there's ways and means, there's different depths of that you can go into these systems, you know, whether even if it's just like hanging out in some of the forums or like, you know, going to like an event or going to a conference or something and just like trying to speak to people, like imagining yourself as like an anthropologist, trying to actually like open yourselves up. Because, you know, beyond all this like fiery politics where, you know, we're like, you know, libertarians slating socialists and socialists like dissing libertarians and so on, actually we're all humans in the end, and we have different interpretations of the struggles we find ourselves in, but actually there's a lot of like common cause that we can find, and actually a lot of the sort of energy is often misdirected. A lot of people who end up in like politically quite backward scenes or politically sort of like, you know, I've met a lot of like hardcore racists and stuff who actually like, you know, I highly disagree with their political views, but you can sort of see that they've been pushed into these quite defensive positions by, you know, being you know, fucked over by giant corporations and stuff, for example.
Yeah.
You know? And then they've sort of taken on this like reactionary right-wing position as a sort of defense mechanism for some situation they find themselves in. And it's not really useful to just like attack in that situation. So yeah, there's a lot to be said for trying to like open yourself up a bit.
Is there any type of like, because in the book, I think you mentioned that you worked as a trader for a bit.
A broker,
like, a broker. So then what's like, how do you deal with that mentally, I guess, if you are you know, trying to learn about a system by like being in it, but also at the same time disagreeing with it, maybe quite quite a bit.
But bear in mind, just as an aside, the global financial system is actually politically quite flexible. I mean, one of the things that a lot of left-wing activists often make a mistake in thinking is that capitalist systems are like quote-unquote right-wing systems. Yeah. Like capitalist systems will co-opt any movement that has you can make profit from. This is why it'll co-opt Black Lives Matter. It'll co-opt like the LGBTQ movement. It'll like, you know, Barclays Bank has got like, you know, in London here, so, you know, supports gay pride marches. You know, they don't give a shit, right? They're all like any like political flavor that you can sell, a corporation will gravitate towards. It's like a profit seeking, you know, machine. It doesn't really care about what you think about yourself. And this is like something that's often like mistaken by left wing activists in thinking that like these corporations really care about the political stuff. You know. When what they really care about is profit, right? And actually, so within banks, you find lots of people who are quite like politically agnostic, actually. Now, of course, conservative right-wing ideology is associated, on the one hand, with some of the wealthiest people in the world because it is a useful ideology if you're trying to protect your wealth, all right? And then you find like a working class version of it, which sort of is like, which is like the story told by right wingers to workers, which is like, you know, don't think about the collective, think about yourself. Think about it's only you and your family in this world. Like, you know, it's all about your own personal effort. And so like, it's sort of like there's like the wealthy version of right wing ideology. And then there's the sort of working class version of it, which echo each other and sort of like play into each other. But within a global bank, the average worker could be left wing or right wing. There's actually like a whole sort of range of like different types of political visions within banks. And the only thing that banks require you to do is to make money. They don't give a shit what you think beyond that. And so like, that's one of the most eye-opening things in these systems is sometimes you realize that they're actually like sort of weirdly apolitical in the way that they're actually like structured inside. Even though they've got huge political implications, it will create political reactions. I mean, even to this day, like Silicon Valley, supposedly this big progressive zone, right? But it's one of the reasons why there's all these like alt-right backlashes is to do. If you do these analyses, you can see it's related to, for example, like the automation tech that Silicon Valley produces. All right, like this is like one of the reasons why, for example, truck drivers will start to like rebel. You know, and turn to like racist narratives about migrants and stuff like that. I mean, I'm kind of just like riffing right now, but you get the point, right? Like the corporate sector follows profit, and then all these like political movements will sort of spin off as a result and in reaction to that. And the whole sort of like art form of like politics is around like trying to position yourself. You know, if you're on the left, positioning yourself in such a way that the right doesn't take advantage of those things that the corporations create. Sorry, so it's like a long, sprawling kind of like answer, but you know, I think this is people got to be more like open to the fact that these scenes are, you know, politically ambiguous.
Yeah, right. So I guess for me, I try to remind myself, like I said, you're going into a system and like there's a lot of different players and you're just one of them. And it's sort of you got to take advantage of like those moments when they happen. Also knowing that most people are apolitical and a bit influenceable, I guess.
Yeah.
OK, so I guess to almost finish up, I was curious if you can give us maybe a little bit of a sneak peek, or you know, let us know what the focus of your next book that's coming out next year.
Sure. It's looking at the intersection of big tech and big finance, and the war on cash is one element of that. I'm looking at the war on cash, this sort of undermining of the state money system, which is what we sort of talked about at the very beginning of this conversation, as sort of one element of a broader process of trying to automate the financial sector, or the sort of intersection of tech and finance, right? And then I look at the crypto community as one response to that, or the sort of the claims made about creating this sort of alternative decentralized form of sort of automated, large-scale automated structures. And then I sort of move forward in the book or conclude by looking at all the sort of new hybridized forms, including some of these things we've been talking about, you know, like the sort of more left-leaning anarchist kind of communitarian approaches to building, I guess, alternatives to both big tech and big finance, and also to like original crypto. So like the sort of like cutting edge, interesting stuff going forward. And that's where I'm leaving the book off there. And then it's going to be hopefully like a kind of manifesto for a new way of moving forward on a lot of the stuff.
Nice. That sounds super interesting. And I know I'll probably definitely pick it up. So thanks a lot for taking the time. Maybe just the last question, if you want to let people know where they can keep up with you and where they can find you.
On Twitter, I'm at SuitPossum, which is SuitPossum. There's a whole story behind that name, but I'm not going to go into it now. I also got a new YouTube channel. If you go to youtube.com/C/Brett Scott, or else you can find it on my Twitter profile. You can find it there. I also have a new website called alteredstatesof.money. So altered states of money with a dot between the of and the money. And you can find all the links there. And that's my new site that I've set up. So yeah.
Nice. I hope people check that out. Thanks a lot for taking the time, and have a good one. It was really interesting.
Cool. Thank you.